Welcome to Two Bees in a Podcast, brought to you by the Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory at the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. It is our goal to advance the understanding of honeybees and beekeeping, grow the beekeeping community, and improve the health of honeybees everywhere. In this podcast, you'll hear research updates, beekeeping management practices discussed, and advice on beekeeping from our resident experts, beekeepers, scientists, and other program guests. Join us for today's program, and thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast.
Hi, everyone. As you know, last month, we got you all ready for March and your beekeeping calendar. And so this is our segment on the April beekeeping calendar. And Jamie, you know, something that we had discussed last month was just making sure that we know what's going on and also planning for the future, right? And so this segment will be specifically on what beekeepers should be looking into and what we should be expecting for the month of April. So I'm really excited.
Yeah, Amy, I agree. I tell you, I think it's so powerful. And I know this is something I'm going to end up saying every month probably, but it's so important and so powerful to understand what bee colonies are trying to do at any given time of year, because, you know, we're managing them. We're trying to work with them as partners and collaborators to maximize their efficacy, productivity, and their health. And so in order to do that, we've got to know what they're trying to achieve. Mm-hmm. And it's no different for April. And as a quick caveat, and I know we did this in the last one as well, we recognize we've got listeners from around the world, including in the Southern Hemisphere. So we're talking about an April management calendar. What I'll do is more broadly talk about the beginning of spring, because while it's not spring for you in the Southern Hemisphere, by the time this comes out, you are going to have a spring at least 6 months from now. And we'll make sure that what we talk about is kind of relevant to what you would see in your spring as well.
Right. And I kind of want to, so Jamie, I kind of want to talk about just, I guess let's start with swarm control. And I have that in my mind because I was in the apiary just recently, and here at the lab, you know, we have lots of different research projects going on. And I know that that's something that we discuss every single week is like, okay, we need to, you know, make sure that we don't have our bee swarm, especially because we're here on campus, right? So we don't want our bees swarming to different locations. And so let's talk about swarm management and I guess just our colonies and what is going on with them, because I think you mentioned this last week, was that there was like a certain plant that bloomed and you knew that as soon as that plant started to bloom, that that meant it was go time for the bees.
Bingo, Amy, you're right. So let's start kind of at the beginning. We ask ourselves, what does April represent in the Northern Hemisphere, so that our Southern Hemisphere friends can think about this? April represents the first few weeks of spring, right? Spring is really happening at this time. So let's back up and ask ourselves, so what are bees doing at this time? Well, back in March, they were just coming out of the tail end of winter. They're starting to grow. Or in April, all those plants that were just starting to bud are really starting to open. So you're starting in early spring, which is represented right now. You're starting to see a lot of plants that are coming on that are producing copious amounts of nectar and pollen. So from a bee's perspective, this is prime swarm season. It's the time of year where the days are lengthening, the sun is warm, the weather's conducive, and more importantly, there's copious amounts of nectar and pollen available. So colonies are expanding quickly, and all of these things are key triggers pushing colonies to want to swarm, to want to swarm, to want to swarm, to want to swarm. And all of you know that swarm season coincides with the prime honey production season. So when your colonies are swarming, you're eating into your bottom line, you're eating into your profit, which is producing honey. So swarm management is really what a lot of beekeepers spend a lot of time doing in April.
All right, Jamie. So we were just talking about swarming and what that is. And so what does swarm management look like? What should a beekeeper do to manage swarms?
Yeah, this is great. So the way that I think about swarm management is that there are a number of biological and environmental triggers that cause colonies to want to swarm. Therefore, swarm management is addressing those triggers that you can address. So let's go through a few of those. Lengthening daylight, warming temperatures, you know, you can't control that. But those two things correlate strongly with blooming plants that produce lots of nectar and lots of pollen. You also can't control that. There's lots of incoming resources. So colonies, as a result, are starting to grow. They're starting to get crowded. Queens are having fewer places that they can lay eggs. They're starting to produce lots of drones. So swarm management is addressing those things that you can control. If crowding is something that contributes as a stimulus to swarming, then alleviate that crowding by supering your colonies. Recognize when it's time to add more space. We know, for example, it's the old queen that swarms with a nest. One management recommendation is to keep young queens in your colonies in spring. As I believe I've shared before on this podcast, I like to clip my queens. So queens have four wings, two big ones and two small ones. I clip half of one big one on one side of their body, and that keeps her from being able to fly away. That's more swarm insurance than management, but nevertheless, it's one of the things I do. A lot of beekeepers will go through their colonies weekly and remove all of the queen cells that are being produced for the purpose of swarming. Once you start getting capped queen cells, colonies are in their final preparation for swarming. So add space, keep young queens, you know, remove queen cells. There, a lot of folks will move the spaces between a strong colony and a weak colony. So let's just say colony A is really strong, colony B is, you know, weaker. So one of the ways to help both of those colonies is in the middle of a day when the bees are foraging heavily, is just swap places on the hive stand. So the weaker colony now gets stronger. The stronger colony kind of reduces in population just a little bit, and it helps everybody. Commercial beekeepers at this time of year in early spring spend a lot of time equalizing colonies, spreading bees and brood and resources between the colonies to make a more uniform apiary, rather than having a few colonies that really want to swarm and then some kind of weak colonies limping along in the background. And another thing I'll say about swarming that maybe we'll discuss more is a lot of folks think about swarm control from the perspective of making nukes or splits. So that's another potential way that you can get on top of swarming.
Okay, so you were talking about swarm management and then making nukes or splits. And so what does that actually look like? I know this is like, it almost seems, Jamie, like it's a lot of information to take in all at one time. And we're talking about it. And I know that especially for beginner beekeepers, once they go out to their colony, they're going to be like, wait, what did Jamie say again? You know, which queen do I take with me and which do I leave behind? And how do I make these nukes and how do I make a split? So I guess let's take a step back and talk about the nukes and splits and what that looks like.
Well, if I'm thinking about swarm control, one thing I could do to help alleviate swarm tendencies is to make splits from colonies. Now, there's so much involved with making a nuke and split, so I'm not going to get into, you know, all the different management ways that you could do it, but I will say if colonies are growing this time of year, if they're getting stronger, if they really want to swarm because their populations are so strong, then as beekeepers, we can make these nukes or splits, which are basically just controlled swarms. When you are splitting out a colony from a bigger colony, you're essentially making it swarm without having to climb the tree to get the swarm. A lot of beekeepers take advantage of this season in which colonies are very strong, and they make nukes and splits. And the beauty of that is it's twofold. Number one, you're helping alleviate the swarm tendency. But number two, you are either producing yourself more colonies or you're making colonies that you can sell. So some people consider making nukes and splits a part of their swarm management process. And it's real simple to do this. I know we've talked about it in previous podcast episodes before, but essentially you go into the strong colony and you remove some frames of bees and some frames of brood, put them into a nuke box or into another full-size hive. And now you've got two hives when you just had one.
Okay, so then you're talking about making two hives, and that means you need two queens, right? So let's get into queens and talk about queen management. And, you know, do people need to go out and buy queens? Are they going to try to raise their own queens? What are your recommendations and what should we be considering going into April?
Yeah, so in my opinion, in early spring, you know, in the weeks leading up to the major nectar flow, which is kind of what April represents for a lot of folks in the Northern Hemisphere, queen management is one of those things that will make or break your production season. So let's just say, for the sake of argument, that you are someone who wants to use your bees to pollinate crops. You got to have strong colonies. It takes queens to do that. Let's say that you make most of your money through honey production. You've got to have strong colonies. It takes good queens to do that. Let's say that you want to sell nukes or splits. You want to make these things and sell bees. That's what you want to do. Well, it takes good queens to do this. So your success as a beekeeper in spring is largely dependent on your ability to manage queens in those weeks leading up to what we would consider the major honey flow or the major pollination season. So queen management is key this time of year. You can lose queens through swarms, right? If you are making nukes or splits, if you're making two colonies from one of those colonies is going to be queenless. So you either have to let that queenless colony requeen itself, or you have to purchase a queen. Amy, you asked a great question. Are queens very available this time of year? Well, I would argue that kind of the month of April, that early spring, that's when queens are starting to hit the market, but they're all almost spoken for already. Oftentimes folks are getting on queen lists all the way back in September and October. So a lot of these early queens are coming on in March and April. For us in the Northern Hemisphere, those queens are already purchased and are already going out to a beekeeper. So it can be difficult to purchase queens from queen production, queen breeders, because they're just such high demand for them. But this is the time of year. You've got to make sure that you don't just have a queen, that you have a good queen. And good gracious, Amy, that's a soapbox I could get on forever. But so many people are satisfied just having a queen. That's not good enough. In April, it's fish or cut bait time. It's the time of year you say, is she a good queen? Because if she's not, I've got to fix it now, because the honey flow, the pollination contract, or my desire to split colonies is right around the corner. Right. And I can only do those things successfully if I've got not just queens, but good queens. So queen management is essential this time of year.
Yeah, you had mentioned honey flow, which, you know, we were talking earlier about how there's more nectar, there's more pollen that's becoming available. And, you know, I have beekeeping friends in the Midwest, and they have honey flows that are so crazy that there's no space in the colony. And so, you know, can you talk a little bit about just monitoring honey flow? Like, when do we add supers? A lot of people will ask that. When do we add boxes to the colonies? What does that look like? What are your thoughts?
Well, I'll tell you, Amy, April and May and early June are the money-making seasons for beekeepers. It's when splits are happening and being sold. It's when packages are being produced and sold. It's when people are using their colonies to pollinate crops. And it's because that's when most of the crops bloom are in spring, right? And it's when the honey flow is happening strong. We are talking about management in the month of April, early spring, to set the stage for our success in spring. So specifically looking at honey flow, exclusively the honey flow, how can we know it's around the corner? Well, number one, you really need to network with local beekeepers, because your local beekeepers who've been keeping bees longer than you will be able to say things like, hey, our major nectar flow starts April 15th. Mm-hmm. It's funny, Amy, every time I'm around a commercial beekeeper and want to illustrate this point for teaching purposes, I'll ask the commercial beekeeper, hey, what's your most important honey producing plant? And they'll tell me what it is based on where they live. And then I say, Amy, well, when does it bloom? And they'll go, it always starts April 23rd, April. It's like they know the date, right? Over the last 40 years that first bud opens. And so if you know what your main honey producing plants are for where you live, you can ask local beekeepers, when do those plants normally start? Just to give you a point of reference, when I lived in Georgia, my major nectar flow kind of started in mid-April and went through May. So I would know, just based on experience and timing, that by mid-April, it was time to start adding supers. Now, some of you may live in colder climates and it be pushed to May or June, or may live in warmer climates and it be as early as February or March, but you need to know when that major nectar flow begins and be ready to have a super on. So for me, if I know that April 15th is the average first date that my major nectar target plant starts blooming, I'm going to have at least one medium super on a week or two leading up to that. The second way that you can know that the honey flow is happening is when you work a colony and remove a frame, you know, they're straight up, they're oriented vertically, and you turn a frame on its side to orient it horizontally and just lightly shake it, just ever so lightly shake it. If liquid is raining out of the combs onto your feet or over the hive or wherever you're slightly shaking that, that is clear evidence that there is an active nectar flow. Nectar is very high in water, so it will fall out of combs easily. And the third thing you look for with major nectar flows is increased bee activity at the nest entrance. And when you are starting to see this, you've got to be ready to super colonies. And Keith Delaplane at the University of Georgia told me one thing that I'll kind of never forget about super and colony. His recommendation is you'd have that super on about a week or two before that major nectar flow historically starts, and that you will add the second super when you take the lid off of the hive and look down on that first super, and bees blanket about 80% of the tops of those frames, then you would add a second super. And then as bees move into that and start working it and blanket about 80% of the top of those frames, maybe a third super. So early spring, you've got to be on watch out for the bees telling you, hey, the honey flow has started or it's about to start. We need you to start giving us some space. So think about what we've talked about so far. Swarm management, queen management, and super management, all to get you ready for whatever you're wanting to do. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would also say that it's probably good to keep record of what's going on in your colony and what, you know, what is blooming when, because if you've missed it, then for next year, you'll know definitely beforehand, oh, last year, I didn't get to it soon enough. And so maybe this year, I'll do it a couple of weeks earlier. All right. So the last thing I wanted to discuss for our April spring management calendar was pests and diseases. This is something that we discuss in just about every single episode, Jamie. I don't think there's ever an episode that we don't talk about pests and diseases. So what do we need to do to get prepared to make sure that we have our pests and diseases under control?
Well, I would argue, Amy, that's such a great question. I would argue that, you know, this April, early April, in this case, early spring, really represents your last chance to solve this problem if you're wanting to get those colonies ready for the honey flow. If it's a pollination contract you're after, or producing bees or brood or nukes or splits or whatever, you're probably okay because you can continue to treat as needed throughout spring. But if honey production is your thing, you need to have had the diseases and pests under control by this point. Why is that the case? Well, let's just pick on varroa since it's such a significant killer of honeybee colonies. Varroa requires treatment when they hit a certain threshold. Let's just say 3 mites per 100 adult bees. Let's say that occurs in mid-April, so a few weeks after spring has started. Well, you know the honey flow is imminent. So if you throw a varroa treatment into your hive per the label, you may not be able to extract any of the honey that the bees make that honey flow because there's a treatment in the hive. So you really need to have diseases and pests under control by the time, you know, that first third of spring is behind you, you know, that first 3 or 4 weeks are behind you, because if you want to produce honey, you're going to have to make a decision. Should I rescue the colony from this issue that I'm having to treat, or should I hope that they survive through the honey flow so that I can produce marketable honey I can use, after which I will treat those colonies? So a lot of beekeepers do math like this. They'll say to themselves, okay, my honey flow is going to start, let's just say for the sake of argument, 15th of April. Then they'll look at their, let's just say, varroa treatments. We'll pick on varroa and say, I'm going to look at a varroa treatment that I would ordinarily use in late winter, early spring. Okay, this treatment says it has to be out, I don't know, 2 weeks before the major nectar flow. So if your nectar flow starts April 15th, you know your treatments have to come out, you know, the last of March. Well, if they have to be in 6 weeks, you got to go backwards into the middle of February and say, what are my varroa populations now? Because if I don't get them under control now, I'm not going to be able by early spring to do anything about it, or I'm going to have to make the decision to solve this problem and not produce honey in that colony. So I would argue in early spring, you know, you're at your last chance to control diseases and pests if you elect to push through the honey flow. Again, if you're wanting to make more bees through packages or nukes or splits, or you're simply interested in pollination contracts, then you can treat during those periods because right. you're not focusing on marketable honey. But if marketable honey is your thing, you've got to have those problems under control by early April. The good news, if there is any with regarding to disease and pest, is early spring tends to be the time of year that colonies, based on incoming resources and just natural biology, outpace the diseases and pests that mm-hmm. are nipping at their heels. So usually, if colonies are looking good, but still there might be something you need to address, you often can put off addressing it until after the honey flow because colonies are outgrowing their problems. So you got to have the problems under control by this point if you're interested in making honey. If not, you're going to have that tough decision. Do I treat and risk not having honey from this colony, or do I get honey from this colony and risk not having a colony in a few weeks? So right. it's a tough time of year, but the good news is more often than not, colonies are outpacing their problems in early spring.
Yep. So we're basically getting stronger at this point, hopefully. And so we discuss, you know, our colonies expanding, having more nectar and pollen. We just discussed some swarm management, queen management, super management with honey specifically, and then, you know, making sure that our pests and diseases are under control. You know, Jamie, I would probably say that I know here in the state of Florida, we have a Florida beekeeping management calendar, and I would encourage our listeners to maybe work with their local associations, their local extension office, if you have one, to put together a calendar so that every month, you know, you can kind of work on this, and throughout the year, you'll end up at the end of the year, have a management calendar. That would be helpful for not just you, but for other beekeepers around you as well.
Amy, that's a brilliant comment. I want to just say that if you're listening to us anywhere on planet Earth, you should have a management calendar relevant to where you live. If it's not been created yet, then you need to work with your local bee club or national bee club or your local professional to generate one. And I'll give one more piece of advice I love to give people. And what a great time of year to hear this piece of advice. Every major honey plant that's important to me in my area of North Central Florida, I have purchased at least one of and planted in my yard. Not because I think my bees are going to make honey on it, but because they provide a natural calendar for when those plants in my area come into bloom. So Amy, this document that you produced, the Florida Beekeeping Management Calendar for Florida beekeepers, it's brilliant. It's great. I love it. Everybody needs one. If you're listening to me in Florida, you need to run and plant the major plants from North Central and South Florida in your yard, depending on where you live. If you're in England listening to us, whatever your major nectar plant is, plant it in your yard, one tree, one shrub, one whatever, because it will tell you when the buds are forming and when it's blooming. It is your botanical calendar to let you know when your bees are. Plus, it's just a good idea to have these great native plants in your landscape so you can enjoy them anyway. So Amy, I agree with you. I love management calendars. I love kind of what's blooming this month. You do a good job with that. And I know a lot of our colleagues around the world do as well. If you're missing that out there, create one for everybody to use, or pester someone until they get it created for you.
All right. So we hope that you find this segment useful. We'll continue doing this, and we'll probably release it just the week before the month starts to at least get you thinking about what you should be doing in the upcoming month.
It's everybody's favorite game show, Stump the Chump.
Welcome back to the question and answer time. Jamie, the first question we have today. So I didn't know this, but apparently stinging nettle has formic acid in it. And so this person is asking, instead of using Formic Pro, can they just put stinging nettle leaves in their hive for mite treatment?
What an interesting question. It's certainly the first time I have ever been asked this question. I didn't know either, Amy, that stinging nettle has formic acid. For those of you who are out there listening who don't know what stinging nettle is, it's a plant that, as the name implies, when you rub up against it, you feel the stings from it. It's got these little tiny fibrous spikes all over them. I had to Google to see if it had formic acid, and sure enough, there's formic acid in those little needles or those spikes of the plant. So that's part of what contributes to the pain that you feel when you are unfortunate enough to encounter stinging nettle. I'm just going to give you another for what it's worth before I actually answer the question. Ants belong to the family Formicidae, and that's because ants have formic acid in them. That's what is in the family name. So if you crush an ant in your fingers and smell your fingers, you will smell formic acid. There
you
go.
Did you have to say ants like that?
Ants. So you could actually put a bunch of ants in your colonies, maybe, and achieve. No, I'm just kidding. But in this particular question is, since stinging nettle has formic acid, can we use that rather than just using some of the products that contain formic acid? And my answer is no. First of all, we don't know how much formic acid is in the stinging nettle. It's possible that it's way more than you want to put in there, in which case the bees might be impacted. It's also possible that it's way less than you want to put in there, in which case it won't work at all. The beauty of using a registered product is it's been created to, when it's used according to label, it's safe for the bees and it kills the varroa. So I certainly love the ingenuity in this question. I also really love the appreciation of the biology and understanding the biology of stinging nettle. However, I would not use stinging nettle or any naturally containing formic acid thing to replace a registered product for formic acid. And beyond that, I just make that statement in general. The same thing like with thymol-based products. I wouldn't necessarily go out and get leaves that contain thymol in it and fill our hives. I would instead rely on the products that have been tested for safety against bees and efficacy against mites, and be able to follow that label in a way to maximize both of those, the safety for bees and the efficacy against mites. And I just think kind of doing something like stinging nettle leaves, you wouldn't be satisfied with the results. So,
right. Well, and also, I mean, would the bees take the leaves and just toss them out?
And that's another thing too. It's like, we don't know how the bees are going to respond to them biologically. Right. And maybe it's bad for them if they're getting poked by all these formic acid bearing needles. Who knows? Who knows? A lot of speculation. That's what I'm saying. It's just too much to figure out. So just, I would argue you use the product.
All right. So the second question we have, I really like this second question that we have. So, you know, beehives, so colonies can thermoregulate, right? And so this person is asking if beehives can be used for insulation for floor or roof or around the walls. You know, is this a reality? And what are problems with this idea? It seems like, I don't know, I had a beekeeping mentor like 6 years ago, and in his kitchen, like right above the sink, he had an observation hive. And so, you know, as soon as I saw this question about insulation, I'm like, I wonder if it was a little warmer right there next to the window. I'm not quite sure.
This is the second question in a row in Stump the Chump that I've never, ever, ever had posed to me. This is a clearly unique one. So the moment, you know, you and I, we read these questions before we come on the air, and I was reading that, and instantly my mind went to me being in a house where above my head in the ceiling, there's just contiguous colony after colony after colony. In the walls, there's colony after colony. And in the floors, there's colony after colony. And I'm just living in this nice little cozy house that's insulated by bee colonies all around. So my mind went to what it would take to actually get a benefit from having those bees around you. And I just don't think we could pull it off. I mean, think about it. The way insulation works is every square centimeter of your roof and your walls and your floor would have insulation in it. And we could not duplicate that with bee colonies. Even if you had bee colony after bee colony after bee colony after bee colony in the wall and the ceiling and the floor, you'd have a different problem, which is, how do you manage all of those things appropriately? How do you keep that many colonies in the wall? There's just lots. So let me answer it two ways. It is hypothetically possible, probably, but logistically impossible. Mm-hmm. And so even still, the bees do not fully occupy an entire cavity. So for every colony that's in this designated cavity in your wall, you know, only a certain percentage of that cavity would be occupied by comb. Right. So you still have the parts that aren't occupied by comb that would be perfect venues to allow cold or heat in and out. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate what you're asking. It's a beautiful idea and I love this concept. I just don't think that it would be very practical to do. Very right. neat question. It, like I said, it instantly put me in a right. glass room where I look above me and see colony after colony in the walls, colony after colony in the floors, colony after colony. And I'm like, man, this is a great place, mm-hmm. but I don't think it'd be possible.
Well, then I was also thinking about like the vermin that could potentially come in. And then, you know, if you've got, well, here in Florida, we do deal with termites pretty often. So if there was like honey dripping out and let's say you had like wood walls, I don't know. And they started to go and termites came in and took over. That may be an issue as well.
Oh, you're exactly right. I mean, if let's just say for the sake of argument, you've got a wall that's got 10 colonies in it for insulation purposes, right. somebody's going to die. And when they die, small hive beetles are going to move in and slam mm-hmm. that whole thing up. And now you've got frothy mess or you've got a couple colonies. It's just, like I said, it's in my mind, it's theoretically possible, but right. I just don't know logistically that it could ever work. It's neat. It's a really neat idea, but I just think logistically it'd be very difficult to overcome.
Okay, so the third question we have, so this person's asking how they can get their queen. So I guess let me take a step back and I'm going to assume that they have two supers. So they've got, you know, the brood box on the bottom and then they got a honey super on top and the queen is probably up on the top box. And so they're trying to figure out how to drive the queen back down to that bottom box. And so do they need to reverse the box positions? Is she going to move down as warmer temperatures continue? I guess I assume that it's also cold where they are right now. So what are your thoughts on this?
I love it because this happens to me every year. In fact, Amy, I have the benefit of looking at the Excel file and this individual's from Augusta, Georgia, which mm-hmm. is just right up the road from where I'm actually was oh. born and raised. I was even born in Augusta, but I was raised
really
about 45 minutes west of there. Yeah, of course.
I have a personal friend that lives there.
Well, there you go.
Shout out to Guy. His name is Guy.
Way to go. All right. So back to the question. So this is Jamie, the beekeeper talking here, not Jamie, the scientist, but my standard hive configuration is one deep Langstroth style hive body for the brood box, a queen excluder on top of that, and then a medium super on top of that. Now, this is not me advocating to all of you listeners out there that this is what you should do. I continue doing what you're doing, what your standard hive configuration is, that's fine. I'm okay with it. Not a problem. For me, it's a deep brood box, queen excluder, a medium super. Well, when winter rolls around, in fact, by U.S. Thanksgiving every year, which is the fourth Thursday every year, for those of you outside the U.S., fourth Thursday in November, I will always take my excluders off of my colonies because what happens is bees kind of migrate upwards in their hives over winter, chasing the food reserves that they usually store above their heads. And if you've got an excluder on, they can move through that excluder and leave the queen behind. I used to hear people say that and didn't believe that it actually happened. But when I moved to Florida, it happened to me once. And so I became a believer and I take off the excluders. And so essentially over winter, my queen has free run of a deep box and a medium super. So when spring rolls around, inevitably, 9.9 times out of 10, the queen has moved into the uppermost box, and that's where she's laying eggs. And just like this questioner, the bees are storing honey in the bottom box. The queen's not moving down into that bottom box. She's in the upper box. So what can I do? What I usually do is find that queen in the uppermost box, in my case, the medium super. I physically pick her up, put her in that bottom box, and I throw my queen excluder back between the two boxes. So the bottommost box and the uppermost box. And I do that because I want the deep box to remain my brood chamber, right? If I were a beekeeper keeping with two deep boxes as my standard configuration, and the queen had moved into the uppermost deep box and was no longer laying in the bottommost box, I'd simply switch boxes. The upper box where the queen was, I'd put on the hive stand. The bottom box where the queen wasn't, I'd move above and it would be the uppermost box now. So long story short, either I find the queen and manually put her in the bottom box and keep her there with an excluder, or I just swap boxes so that the one she's occupying is the one on the bottom.
Sounds good. All right. Well, those were our question and answers for today. Thank you so much. Those were really fun. I feel like the questions, Jamie, are getting like more and more creative every time, you know, yeah, just things that we haven't thought about.
I know if you think, Amy, you know, we have the benefit of knowing this behind the scenes, but we just recorded an intro for our 100th episode. That means we've answered, you know, 300 or more questions on the air. It's pretty incredible to think about. So it's been fun and people are getting creative, just like what you say.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast. For more information and resources on today's episode, check out the Honeybee Research Lab website at ufhoneybee.com. If you have questions you want answered on air, email them to us at honeybee@ifas.ufl.edu or message us on social media at UF Honeybee Lab on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. This episode was hosted by Jamie Ellis and Amy Vu. This podcast is produced and edited by Amy Vu and Sarah Sowers. Thanks for listening and see you next week.